Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's take it from the top.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 471 for the week of August 7th, 2023. I am Elevator Blood David T. Cole, and I'm here with Table Read Train Wreck Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh my God, it's me.
Girl Cop Tara Ariano.
You can't see me, but I'm doing a secret handshake right now.
And Zoologist by Day, Crime Fighting Cobra by Night, David Weeb.
Just Cobra. The makes me sound like an asshole.
Oh, speaking of sounding like an asshole, hello listeners. It's me, Sarah D. Bunting. We are about to make an important announcement about the podcast that could be of interest to you, whether you're not a Patreon and have no plans to become one, or if you are a Patreon who's happy with your level of support. In other words, this is an announcement for potentially everyone. So please listen.
All right, so at the first of the month last week, Patreon erroneously removed people from all Patreon creator accounts, including ours. Now you're asking yourself, why? Well, because they moved their billing to Ireland or something like that, which A, smells like some sort of Tatch Dodge scam, so boo, but also B, triggered fraud bells at credit card companies across the board, resulting in tons of non-renewals.
Most inconveniently for us, Patreon can't or won't retry the charges, so unless the affected supporters resubscribe, we have lost your support. So if you're listening to this on the free feed because your supporter feed stopped working, all of that is probably why. Please sign up again at patreon.com/extrahotgrate with our apologies on Patreon's behalf. For the hassle. And since we're here, this is potentially true for all of the Patreons you support. So when you have a second, do a little audit, make sure you're covered on all of your pledges.
There is, however, a silver lining to all of this, which is that we're taking this moment to rearrange our campaign milestones. As of this taping, we are a mere whisper away from hitting $5,000. And here's what will now happen when we do. We will unlock Kim Reed's most awesome thing.
Woo!
The return of Kim and the most awesome thing she watched on TV. Once a dang month. We will also be unvaulting all the EHG minis, and literally there are over 600 of them, by adding one or two to the end of Extra Extra Hot Grate every week.
And then at $5,250, we'll unlock the Forcing Pool. Every $5 support gets you one ticket to be the person who forces us to watch an episode of TV that you will choose. Whatever you want. Maybe something good. Maybe something bad. Do your worst. And we'll also have a one-off live game time night on Zoom for anybody who wants to come play live with me as your game master.
At $5,500, we will unlock a quarterly look at this month in historical TV. This will be a drill down on the pop culture world that was.
And at $5,750, we'll unlock cannon fodder. You want more cannons? Cannons of different sizes and styles. Anything is possible with a second canon segment each week.
And then our last rearranged milestone will be at the $6,000 mark, when we will unlock the newly confirmed monthly Mademoiselle Caroline report. That's right. We've hooked her. She's in. She's going to tell us what is happening in the worlds of supernatural, psych, I suppose. I'm sure other things. There's only one way to find out. That's to get us there. And then also at that same pledge level, we will be doing a one-off, this is a terrible idea, Drunk Dave call-in show. You got questions about TV that I need to answer while inebriated? Well, this is the milestone for you.
Thank you so much to everyone who has supported the campaign thus far and to everyone for whom these new milestones convince you to join us. We hope our latest bonus episode was actually longer than the main episode last week. So you really do get a lot of value for your pledge. And we're having so much fun making these episodes for you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So once again, go to patreon.com/extrahotgreat to confirm your membership is still active, or extrahotgreat.com/club for details on all these campaign perks, what you're going to get for your dough. Thank you for your support. We absolutely do appreciate it. And now on with the show.
Joining us for the first time, he is a former TV executive and note giver, now a writer-producer. Welcome, David Weeb!
Yeah! David Weeb! Thank you.
Also thank you. Personal friend.
That's
so
right.
So we're going to make fun of him a lot.
It's you should. It is a huge honor to be on the podcast.
Stop it.
I am so grateful to be the beneficiary of whatever designated survivor situation that allowed me to take the place of someone far more qualified. So thank you.
That's exactly how it happened.
Not true. Stop it, Dave. We are here to talk about season 3 of Only Murders in the Building. Oliver, Martin Short, has gotten the break of a lifetime, the chance to revive his career by directing a whodunit on Broadway. Not only that, but his leading man is Hollywood A-lister Ben Glenroy, Paul Rudd. Unfortunately, Ben is a dick who has made a ton of enemies in the rehearsal phase, so when he collapses on stage opening night, possibly due to poisoning, the list of suspects is long. But then he's revived at the hospital and comes to the Arconia for Oliver's opening night party, determined to mend his relationships with everyone in the show, almost. But then he falls through the top of an elevator, definitely dead this time, in the building. Who did it? And more importantly, will Charles, Mabel, and Oliver do a third season of their podcast about it? The first two episodes dropped on August 8th. That's yesterday, as you were listening to this. We got access to the first 8. We will be careful about plot spoilers for episodes beyond the first 2. Let us do the Chen check-in. David, should our listeners watch season 3 of Only Murders in the Building?
I think I've listened long enough. I can do a heavily qualified yes.
Looking forward to hearing what the qualifications are. Sarah.
Yes.
Dave.
With the caveat that this is my first time watching this show, I thought it was fine, and I will say probably best watched with your secretly sweary grandmother.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that.
I don't either.
Let's get into it. Like a lot of shows that shoot in actual New York, this one has always been great at casting character actors in secondary and tertiary roles. But season 3 has two huge A-list stars, the aforementioned Paul Rudd as Ben. We also have Meryl Streep as Loretta, an actress who has been struggling for decades and for whom Oliver's show is her big break. David, how well did you feel they fit into the ensemble?
I mean, the casting in this season is fantastic. And as the season goes on, there's even a few more surprises on casting. Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep and Paul Rudd are fantastic. I will say Meryl Streep is radiant. Can I say radiant? Am I allowed to say that?
You get one.
Every time she's on, Paul Rudd is hilarious. Even Andrea Martin. So much so that I feel like they're out-acting the core cast members. Mm. And in a lot of scenes where they're either playing, you know, one-off with one of our heroes, it's clear who the stronger actor is in the room. But I will say from a in terms of casting standpoint, I loved all the new additions. It made me go back and maybe doubt our heroes a little bit in terms of their abilities.
I have trouble with comparing some of your acting greats, your Meryl Streeps, when there are long people like Martin Short. Because Martin Short is acting as Martin Short always does in a vaudevillian fantasy of his making. And then everybody else is doing probably what the script is calling for. Weirdly, this is like the one project I've seen him in the past decade or so that it actually works with that instead of totally 100%. Against it. Like, do you remember him in Arrested Development and that super terrible episode?
Yeah, the Nodak one.
Awful.
Terrible. And he was just doing kind of the same shtick, just heightened that he's doing. Ed Grimley is like a slice of this, right? Then he's got this whole repertoire that it gets just like less manic and more boring. Mm. But God help me, it actually kind of like he actually fits here. He's not the square peg.
Yeah, Sarah and I were talking about this actually yesterday. So Sarah, speak on that because I agree he is very well directed here.
He is. And I think that Dave Cole is right. And the show from the beginning has known that they should sort of steer into this and just let him be this, like write the character as this extremely outre personality that seems very sort of like New York in a certain milieu. But he's kind of been doing this like yelly locked joints thing since Inner Space and Three Amigos, which was 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of directors and casting agents don't exactly, that they're like, oh, he'll calm down. And it's like, well, I mean, maybe, but cast him and understand what you're getting. And this project always has that let him let some, what Tara and I were saying earlier today, are the wistful elements. They sort of underline the contrast. Mm-hmm. Because he's usually so much. And how many reviews are like, this is the only time I've been able to stand Martin Short since Clinton was president.
I said that last week.
I think much like Bob Fosse has mentioned in the show, it'll be the fifth heart attack that kills Martin Short.
You did read his biography. Yeah, that was a good line. Yeah, I think they underscore that, like, I wrote about this for Cracked, and we'll link it in the show notes, but I watched 28 episodes of Only Murders in the Building across 3 days, which I don't think is how the creators intended it to be consumed. Nevertheless, that's what occurred.
That's like a level over binge. What would you call that?
Gorge?
Yeah, gorge.
Yeah. I mean, I don't... Maybe that's not how they intend it. I'm sure it isn't, because that's not how it's released. But in my experience with the show, it is better to... It's better to watch it all in a chain and not have time to think about it in between weeks. Just my opinion.
But Tara, I do want to know, in watching all three seasons back to back, did you notice as you went from season one to season two to season three, the show evolve, devolve? Like, you saw it all happen over 3 days.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's like a different show from season to season, but they, you know, they, of course, are obviously are different stories. And I see the evolution in the characters for sure. And what I was going to say about starting it from the beginning less than 1 week ago, that you see this in the way that Oliver Martin Short's character is created, like right from the very first episode where he goes, one of the first things we see him do is go to his son's house in New Jersey, like hat in hand, asking for money because he can't afford his fancy Arconia lifestyle anymore at the where his career is now. And his son is like, I'm tapped out. And this is like part of what drives the creation of the podcast, however improbably, and you know, it ends up making sense. But there were several episodes where I was like, what the fuck? These five-figure amounts of money they're being given randomly to make this probably not very good podcast. But anyway, I appreciate how the show lets the characters grow. And I think that's one of the biggest strengths. And that's some of what I wrote about today for Cracked, which is like, it's good at world building. And we definitely see that pay off in season three as like characters who have had very small roles in previous seasons come to the fore, like Howard, the Michael Cera Creighton character who must be Oliver's assistant on the show, and has more of a spotlight than he has before. And as I write, it's one of the big strengths of the show is like filling out the whole show where you feel like anyone could be anything at any time. Anyone could be important. It also underscores the overarching show story of the whole show, which is people finding each other in unlikely ways and making this unlikely friendship. This unlikely, extremely unlikely basis of people continuing to get murdered in this apartment complex, which is like big. It's not that big. Like, you know, there's probably what, like 80 units in this place. It's like three murders in 3 years is quite a lot. Honestly.
That should have showed up on Zillow by now, right? Like that would be.
Maybe it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. For the person playing the actress who has never made it to be Meryl Streep is a meta joke literally any person can get. Do you feel like they keep it on the right side of winky? I mean, David, you were sort of saying there she's outshining the leads, but in a bad way or just in a way that's kind of inevitable?
I think that probably threw me in the first episode is that the whole opening of the episode is her backstory. Mm-hmm. And seeing how she's longed to be on the stage and in the theater and seeing Oliver realize in that moment, oh my gosh, where have you been? And then her first opportunity at a table read is to do a bunch of inappropriate accents, which is funny, but maybe out of character for what you've just spent all this time establishing is, and then suddenly she's unable to do table reads. And maybe that's the reason why she's never cast. But I think it was moments like that, especially in the first episode, kind of made me go, it took me out of the moment. But from then on, whenever we do see her, again, probably like any Meryl Streep role, you totally buy, like you're sucked in. Unlike Martin Short, you're not going, this is Martin Short playing this role. You're going, oh yes, this is Loretta. And this has always been Loretta.
Yeah.
It took me out of it. But then when I was thinking about it, I thought, I don't think they had a choice in terms of like hanging the biggest possible ghost light, so to say, on the fact that this is Meryl Streep. And these are all the things that, like, these are all the sort of bold type things that everybody knows about fellow Summit, New Jerseyan, Meryl Streep. So I thought that that was a smart choice. And she is clearly having a ball. I don't think I've seen her having this much fun since Miranda Priestley. And she ate that up as well. So I think that that was, again, smart, that if you're going to cast this living legend, that it's like, all right, let's just get all the jokes out of the way and then we can let the story settle.
Yeah.
So I was fine with that. And also that this show, Tara's review is excellent and I recommend that everyone read it because it focuses on the world building. And I think that that's the most wonderful and important part of this show is that it's satirizing a lot of different things, true crime podcasting, but also New York theater, Upper West Side living, all of these things. But it has a deep knowledge and deep familial fondness for the things that it parodies. Mm-hmm. So it works in a way that sometimes a lot of recent properties that think they're satirizing the true crime craze, they can't pull it off because they don't love it. They don't even know it that well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is something that the show does extremely well. That actress, capital T, capital A, is definitely a thing. And that it's Meryl Streep playing her. I think they hit those notes just right under the Cirques.
Yeah, I would say for anyone who enjoys humor at the expense of actors making a lot of choices, there's an episode of The Other Two this season, also set at a procedural. That's very funny about this as well. And speaking of people making jokes about their image, no one is doing this more than Ant-Man himself between this and the season of Party Down, which he was an executive producer on. Like, he is really biting the Marvel hand. Like, David, do you think he's done it enough, or are you fine with him doing it as much as he cares to?
This may be an incident of first episode-itis, but again, there were moments when he came in where it's like, oh, I've seen him do this character on Parks and Rec or a little bit in Anchorman. And then there is this really beautiful fantasy moment, Mabel later on, where she talks to his girl cop character.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you realize he's more than just a, you know, someone who does great jokes and okay, who farted? Like that, like he really shines there. And I think it's a great combination of the two. And I think you realize as you go further deeper into the show that you want more of Paul Rudd. And again, from a budget perspective, maybe they could only afford so much Meryl Streep and so much Paul Rudd and some of the other guest characters that you're not seeing them as much. But I wanted to see more of those scenes that humanized this kind of oafish, outlandish actor character that he seems to be parodying in the first episode.
Yeah, that part, the girl cop scene is great. Also, where he finally confronts Charles, I believe this is in the first two episodes, where he's like, you don't even remember why I hate your guts. And when he's talking about, like, I was supporting my parents.
I was supporting my family.
Like,
yeah,
it's like,
that was like,
that's a fucking
Yeah, the show could do that sometimes. Yeah. That you're just like, I mean, it's that's one of the reasons that I love it, even when it's not like A plus every second. I feel like it tries to do things and has a certain confidence in various tones that I always look forward to it. And I'm glad it's back, and I'm glad it's back in form. Season two is a little off, but it's great so far. I think season three.
Linda Hammond as Donna and Wesley Taylor as Cliff, the creepy producers who are kissing on the mouth all the time, even though they are mother and son. That was great. Linda Hammond, who Sarah and I saw on Broadway in the Philip Seymour Hoffman Death of a Salesman. I thought she was great.
I was just referring to that in terms of talking about Finn Wittrock's performance and how that whole performance had roles that you don't usually think of as any way except the same way you've seen it done a million times.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that she was excellent in that and sort of memorable and thought-provoking in that role that sometimes can fade back.
Yeah.
In that. So yeah, she's always brilliant, but I've had a soft spot for her since that production.
Incredible Coats as well.
I really liked Andrea Martin in this. I think Andrea Martin, like Martin Short, historically has not been cast to her strengths and has had a tendency to play more of these outlandish, over-the-top characters. And there's a little of that, you know, pushing through at moments. But I also feel like her moments with Charles and going over the relationship, again, I thought those were really strong moments. Felt the Andrea Martin disappear and the character, you know, really shine through there.
Mm-hmm. I also love the detail that this CBS procedural, the Brazos revival that they're both working on, is on hiatus because its executive producer is under investigation for sexual harassment, like all executive producers of CBS procedurals, apparently. Also, the fact that it's called Brazos, like, I don't know. I go back and forth on deciding whether the producers know what Brazzers is. And if you don't, I mean, look it up or ask a young person. But
I don't.
I'm sure they do.
It's dirty. Mabel actually maybe finally moving out. I didn't expect this show to make me hope for a flimsy plot contrivance that would somehow let her keep it, and yet I did. I'm really sad if she actually does. We don't know based on the 8 episodes if it actually occurs for reals.
I'm glad they're going there in terms of like the realism of, you know, would she really still have this place and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Another thing that I respect about this show is that sometimes they see that something is not working and they just like pivot. That might be something that they're doing here, or maybe her having to redecorate and maybe move is, you know, just a nod to credibility. But I don't know why they would bother. Like, this is a magical realism show. So just let her live there. It's fine.
Yeah.
Let her hit a scratch-off ticket. Not a big deal. We can do this.
Totally. I'm curious to know if this will finally be the season where we get to find out who her aunt is, because it feels like they've been holding that back for some kind of incredible reveal, and especially with all the Broadway stuff, I'm like, will it be Cheetah Rivera or someone like that?
Well, that was going to be my next question. Who are you casting as her aunt?
That's the first person I thought of, and I don't think I could do better. I mean, it would be a great aunt, I guess, but still.
I'd go for Gara.
Okay, yeah, I could see that. Before we wrap up, any early guesses? Who killed Ben? David?
Something I was watching a little deeper into the season last night with my wife, and Robert just feels like maybe too obvious of a choice. She misremembered it was Selena's girlfriend from last season who was the killer, and I had to go, no, that was a misdirect. It just feels like he's too good of a guy, too much of a companion to not have a big reveal at the end, but that's who I'm going with.
Okay, Sarah.
I've only watched 2 because this is we watch it as a household show.
Sure.
So I couldn't go too far into the season without violating my marriage vows. So I'm still on Loretta, but I doubt it. Like, that's what they want me to think. So who knows if I should think that.
Law and Order rules, right?
Right.
Biggest name.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Doesn't come into the show just to be some person that didn't do it. I'll say Andrea Martin did it. Andrea Martin, the actor, not the character she plays.
Frank's character to have done it.
Yep.
Amazing.
Super meta.
I think it's maybe I'm looking at his brother, Dickie, played by Jeremy Shamos. I think there's some anger there, and it could have resulted in a elevator shaft push. So we shall see many weeks from now. If any of us was right.
It's time to go around the dial. Choo-choo, around the dial, train's back. Our first stop is with Tara.
Why is it a train?
Now, why does a train go around in a circle, you may ask? Depends how big the circle is. Small circle, useless. Big circle, the size of a country, very useful.
Sure. Physical is back on Apple TV Plus for its 3rd and final season. This is a show where Rose Byrne plays Sheila, a housewife who becomes an aerobics entrepreneur, and that I think I at least hoped would be another Glow, and then it turned out to be an extremely dark comedy about disordered eating, not like Glow, really. At the end of season 2, we see a little footage of Sheila's new rival in the step aerobics space, who is a sitcom star named Kelly Kilmartin. They very deliberately did not show her face in that scene, and you just knew it was so that they could cash someone splashy for season 3, and they have, and it's Zooey Deschanel. She's playing kind of a dual role. She's the real Kelly Kilmartin, who stars in Trish Out of Water, in which a Southern belle gets caught shoplifting and is sentenced to be a lifeguard, which I love. It's very 80s. In this capacity, she gets booked on The Tonight Show to do a sexy demonstration of her step aerobics program with Johnny and Ed, who are, you know, CG'd to make it look like they are doing aerobics with her. But Deschanel also plays a version of Kelly who is the embodiment of Sheila's insecurities. In the first two seasons, Sheila's compulsive behaviors were driven by her verbally abusive inner monologue. She had quieted that in season two with the help of her eating disorder group meetings, but now her fantasy of Kelly has replaced it. And as hard as it can be to hear some of the shitty things that she says to undermine Sheila, the show is a pitch black comedy. Deschanel is obviously having an absolute blast playing this extremely chirpy little bitch of a character. Also still around is John Bream, the Pulp Sparks character. He's the self-hating Mormon businessman that Sheila spent most of season two having an affair with. I personally feel like his narrative purpose has been served and they don't really have that much to do with him. Maybe he will have important things to do later on. I have not watched ahead. It covers some very rough topics. Will certainly not be for everyone, but I think it handles the material very thoughtfully and insightfully. I'm hopeful it'll bring things to a satisfying close, even if that might not be a happy ending for Sheila or possibly other people in the show, but it's well done. It's just, it's rough. I would not say get a trial membership of Apple and then binge it. No pun intended, because it's too much. For my plug, TV comedy shows need to quit killing dogs. I feel, and I wrote about that at Cracked, it's more than you would think. And in fact, after I filed it, I was like, oh, fuck, there's another one I even actually forgot. So that'll come up later. But it's spoilery, so be warned. But yeah, knock it off. There's a reason that the trigger warning site is called Does the Dog Die? Because no one wants to see that, and it's not funny.
I know you said you shouldn't binge physical, but what if you gorged it? Is that okay?
I don't recommend that either. Okay.
Mr. Weeb, what have you been watching recently?
I have a bit of a more unconventional choice. I've been watching the Letterman channel on YouTube. It's pretty self-explanatory. Dave Letterman, arguably the most influential talk show host of all time, brilliantly negotiated ownership of the entire run of The Late Show, and his curated YouTube channel is a place to find his and former staff members' favorite moments, top 10 lists, stand-up performances, interviews, etc. But the hidden jewel on this site is something called Letterman Originals, and these shorts can run from 90 seconds to 10 minutes, and they're mostly made up of Dave and his longtime show producer, Barbara Gaines, or current Worldwide Pants producer, Mary Barkley. And it's mostly an opportunity for Dave to act in what, it feels like his own words, a bit of a goofball. Typically set in what I assume to be the offices of Worldwide Pants. You can actually hear the phones ringing in the background. Dave presents himself as the guest to either Barb or Mary's host. In fact, Dave refers to these originals as episodes of the Barbara Gaines show and always promises to be brief because he knows they have other guests. He's always asking, do we have enough time for this? To which Barbara says, yes, of course, we have all the time in the world. Now, I grew up with Dave Letterman, and while I always enjoyed his interviews, they were never the drawing card for me, or maybe many of his viewers. It was always, you know, the more seemingly improv bits where he catches up with Paul or just ruminates on what's going on in the world with the audience, where you saw more of Dave's actual personality, and that's all this is. The subject matter is exclusively the inane and minutiae, including topics such as what's on Dave's iPad, or life hacks like brushing your teeth when you shower, sold as secrets your dentist don't want you to know, his unsuccessful bid to buy Twitter, and a lengthy explanation that he was not, in fact, beaten up at the Netflix Comedy Festival. The most recent video has him dressing up as a stock boy and working at a Hy-Vee, which is some sort of regional grocery chain, something very reminiscent of the bits he used to do on both of his late night shows. If you love Letterman, this is a nice dip back into what he's doing that requires very little investment, and it just makes me smile.
Here's hoping he gets back on the roof and throws stuff off a roof again.
One of the episodes he actually films and what he says is the roof of the Trump Towers. I'm guessing it's not that, but it's got a great New York skyline. Ooh, do I get to do a plug?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, plug.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I cannot tell you about the Netflix animated series I'm currently story editing, not because of strike reasons, mind you. It just hasn't been announced. Same with the series I'm producing for Universal. Both of these are launching in 2024. But the one thing I can talk about is a series I created and show ran almost 10 years ago called Life in the Dream House.
Woo!
This is still streaming on Netflix, and it has no doubt received a Barbie movie bump from Greta Gerwig's wildly successful feature film, but critics and fans are now rediscovering it thanks to its similar tone. In fact, last week it came in number 6 on Netflix global rankings. So check it out. And I'm also on Instagram and Twitter as DavidMJW and Big House Stories. And occasionally I post stuff there.
Okay, Dave, can you do a promo for, you know, our little radio promos? You're going to say, my name's Dave Weeb, creator of such and such. And then, and you're going to say, I'm coming for you, Barbie.
Yeah, can we do that at the end of the show?
Yeah, sure, we can do it at the end of the show.
I just kidding, I still have contractual ties to Mattel, and I am forbidden from saying anything negative about them.
All right, Sarah, what do you got?
Well, there's really no segue from Barbie to Bourdain, but that's just going to have to do. I happen to be listening to an Anthony Bourdain book, Medium Raw, right now, read by the author. And he makes passing mention of starting out as a dishwasher in Provincetown on Cape Cod, which he was allowed to do all by himself at the age of 17 years old. I would not have survived such an experience. He barely did, as he says fondly. So I thought I would check out his Massachusetts episode from season 4 of Parts Unknown. He starts out in Provincetown. He eats some meals that look delicious. He goes out scallop fishing with the locals. That also looks delicious. And then he heads into Western Massachusetts to eat raspberry pie at a diner, see above in Ray Delicious, and talk to the locals about the opioid epidemic's long reach into the state. As always with Bourdain content, now, 5 years after his death, I find it both heartening in its generosity, its profanity, its righteous curiosity, the sense of his shows keeping the document in documentary, and frustrating because we won't get any more of this content. But, you know, if he had ever shifted to a criminal justice or crime story focus in his filmed work, as he did periodically in his writings, he could have reset the bar for the whole genre, but the fact is he actually has a shit ton of content that he did make. So heartening, frustrating, back to heartening, much like the average episode of Parts Unknown. But I'm still a little mad that he never got into true crime, because he could have called it Anthony Bourdain Guns and Butter. Come on, universe, do I have to do everything? Anyway, Parts Unknown is a travel show for people who don't like travel shows, a food show for people who don't like food shows, and an educational history show for just about any people at all. I miss Bourdain, but I can like nestle in all of the content that he did leave for us. And for that, I thank him. And included on that list of content randomly, this is like a mind blower that I love to drop on people. He wrote a monograph on Typhoid Mary. It's really good. It is a thing that exists. It is a thing I reviewed, and you can read that and all the other true crime content that Eve Beatty and I try to get our arms around on a weekday at bestevidence.fyi.
What if, Dave, you said, I'm coming for you, suits.
You got it.
All right. Before I get into what's happening on the Extra Hot Great Cinematic Universe, I just want to explain how to watch Star Trek now that Star Trek has one of those franchise stinger bumper things at the start of their shows now too. Started with Marvel, and then Star Wars is like, I got to get into this action with these stupid shiny robot head things they're doing. And now here's Star Trek coming in, and this is how you watch it. All right, Enterprise, here we go. Time to deliver another fresh batch of rainbows.
Every week.
I should preface that as I will find this funny, but nobody else will. But that's how you watch it. Mm-hmm. All right. Coming up on the next Extra, Extra Hot Great, which will drop for supporters this Friday. It is Prime Video's Red, White, and Royal Blue movie that is kind of on TV, so we're going to cover it. In addition to that, we've got Recast This, which Tara Charges recast The Wire. And let me tell you, I had so much difficulty, I had to do a big zig. A big zig! ExtraHotGreat.com/club to find out about all that. And then right here in the next EHG Prime, it is Telemarketers. So we'll welcome back Bobby Krutt for that. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Julie. Take it away, Julie.
New York, the first question you get asked when you meet someone new is, what do you do or where do you work? In Chicago, it's where did you go to high school? I know this because I moved back to Chicago somewhat recently after living in New York for many years. I forgot how small town this big city really is. Coming back to your hometown can be slightly excruciating because you are always reminded of who you once were, and maybe that's why you left in the first place, and it's more extreme when the city you left Chicago for is New York. This tension is expressed so well throughout season one of The Bear, and is particularly palpable in episode four, Dogs, my canon submission. I resisted choosing the season one finale or any of the other great episodes of this season because this episode was a turning point in the series arc. The show had hit its stride by then, and by taking much of the action outside of the restaurant to Carmi and Richie's quasi-nephew's birthday party, the show revealed what it's really about, the family you choose versus the one you're born into. For better or worse, the beef is home for Richie and has become home for Carmi, despite the restaurant's tiny, greasy, stressful confines. There, the roles are clear, the chaos is manageable, and at least for Carmi, it's a place to excel. Outside of the beef, at the party, there's a sort of funhouse claustrophobic environment. The party is filled with people who've known Carmi and Richie forever and still razz them as if they were kids. When Carmi's goober of a brother-in-law, Pete, tries to tell everyone how Carmi is a world-class chef, no one listens and no one cares. I suppose I wouldn't either if Help Me Rhonda were blaring in my ears the way it does in this scene, and which precluded me from sharing a clip. I mean, really, what is up with all the wall-to-wall needle drops in shows these days? I am not a crackpot. But even that does not dim this episode's canon worthiness. This party is an unforgiving environment, and that has nothing to do with the Beach Boys' worst song ever. But maybe their family and friends aren't wrong, because when Carmi and Richie are together, they bicker and fight as if they were still kids. I could literally just pull all of their dialogue together in one long stream. It's so funny. There's this exchange as Richie tries to dress a giant inflatable hot dog in a bun with one of the restaurant's t-shirts.
Why are you doing that? What? Why are you trying to put a t-shirt on a fucking hot dog?
Kids love hot dogs, dumbass.
I know, that's why we're making them fucking hot dogs, dumbass.
Yeah, exactly, cousin. It's a tie-in. Shit is exposure, baby.
I don't need you exposing anything.
Hey, it's a fucking hot dog in a beef t-shirt. That shit is hilarious.
They get into a juvenile slap fight that ends with Richie falling on and deflating the hot dog. And then Richie says,
ah, fuck! What you did, fucking baby. All right, I'm gonna get the spare from the basement.
Or this one, which is a great nod to the fact that putting ketchup on a dog in Chicago is a no-no.
Which box you put the ketchup in? The ketchup, which box?
I didn't bring ketchup.
Why didn't you bring ketchup?
What kind of asshole is gonna put ketchup on a hot dog?
A child, Richie.
Child asshole.
You're a child asshole.
The inflatable hot dog makes a final appearance at the party, this time with a t-shirt haphazardly duct taped to it. The funniest part of the episode happens when Richie accidentally spikes the punch with Xanax, and all of the kids fall into deep slumbers in the backyard. And then Uncle Cicero comes upon the scene.
Oh, fuck. Fuck, shit.
Get a little more ketchup here.
Thanks.
What?
Don't kill me.
Oh, I can't wait for this.
We spilled a bottle of Xanax in the cooler.
What, are they fucking dead?
No. I think they're just sleeping.
Actually, I'm kind of into it.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Somehow, miraculously, in this short episode, we see the layers of dysfunction in Carmi's family. All of the secrets, the unspoken truths, that pain and curiosity that comes when you've missed the chance to get to know your parent. There's tenderness and love, too. And a nice turnabout when the goober brother-in-law, the outsider, is the stealth hero of the episode. He loves his chosen family so much, he's the one to nearly succeed in knitting it back together. Back at the Beef, we get a sense of what a functional family looks like. There, Chef Sydney is working on establishing order in the kitchen. Like the best kind of parent, she firmly coaxes her stubborn line cook, Tina, into making great mashed potatoes and has given Marcus, the baker, the confidence to flourish. I love how the camera gently and lovingly captures everything Marcus does, and the donut porn is something to behold. The show ends as all the chefs at the Beef gather to enjoy Marcus's cake. A sense of familiarity fills the room. Everyone's allowed to be who they are, even if it means sitting alone and not talking. There's a reason restaurants call this ritual family meal. It reminded me of the two-episode Burger Chef arc from Mad Men and the terrific scene where Don, Pete, and Peggy share a meal as their personal lives basically go to shit. But that's another episode for the canon. I find the bear to be a bit of a miracle. The authentic Chicago-ness, which is done better here than in any other book, TV show, or film I can think of, is a nice bonus, but it's the show's elegiac tone that makes it so good. And it's never better than in episode 4, where even as it mourns so much, the future of American cities, broken families, and addictions, we still get some great deflated wiener jokes.
Thank you, Julie. Mr. Weeb, you want to take first crack at the canonworthiness of this episode and Julie's presentation of?
I do. Thank you. First of all, excellent presentation. She needs to be on her own podcast. And I will admit, I selected this from a list of candidates, and I probably did so flush with the euphoria of just finishing season 2 and maybe want to go back into the first season. She highlighted every single thing I like. Oh, this is a favorite moment, down to I may have written down food porn. She said donut porn. They do that so well. And I think what I really enjoyed about this that she captured is this was the first excursion really taken out of the Beef. This, which is really what season 2, they just do it the whole time. But this is the first time in the first season, which may be a little bit more of an experiment, you know, for the showrunners to say, let's see what this show is when it's not all the chaos in the kitchen. Tara said earlier about Only Murders in the Building is that the evolution of relationships in this show is done so well. It's not, you know, even though this goes into comedy categories for some reason, it's not a sitcom. It's not reset back to one, the same arguments over and over again. And that Tina and Sydney relationship that you know where it's going, but it starts off so harsh. And you're cringing because you know there are people, whenever you've been in a work situation, who like, oh, did they just say that to the boss? You can't say that to the boss. So I was really happy to go back and revisit an episode from the first season when we don't all have the luxury of going back and rewatching previous seasons because there's so much TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's not really a sitcom, but I do think that at least season 1, this episode reminded me it was definitely funnier in season 1. Like, There are a lot of very funny moments in this episode, and I would not have necessarily thought of this for our first canon pitch on the bear, but I definitely get it. And all of the stuff that comes around, as Julie said, about Carmi and Richie leaving the restaurant is so good. Starting in the parking lot where it's like, why would you inflate the hot dog before you put it in the car? Like, inflate it when you get there, you idiots. But like, this is a show about people who are idiots. And that's like, that's part of it. Richie, he's distracted by watching presumably World Star on his phone and doesn't even notice at first that Carmi is driving to the wrong suburb. And then is like, yes, yes, I'll be cool. Hard cut to him fighting viciously with Uncle Jimmy before they're even inside the house. There's a lot of funny in this. I mean, I also am not sure, despite what Julie said, that it necessarily was an accident to dose the Ecto cooler with Xanax, because it seems like that was a party that needed it, based on what we see earlier of the kids like opening the birthday boy's presents before he can even get to them.
And Cicero screaming, it fucking sucks in here.
That's so good.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. There's a lot, like every interaction we see with every uncle is like, you can project out the world of their relationship. Like, it's the writing is so economical and so good that like, it's a very well thought through show. And I think the humor, the real comedy comes from the truth of all of the relationships as they're portrayed on the show, including with Sydney and Tina, where it's like you said, we know where it's going, but like, just hurry up and get there because stop fighting. Like, I know why you are, but it's so unnecessary. And especially for Sydney, who just is like completely flummoxed by Tina's attitude of being like, I'm not the bitch here. And like, and then she's not when she's like, all right, go ahead and tell me it's bad. She's like, no, it's great. And is completely casual about it. Like, yeah, that's a good manager.
Mm-hmm.
And get me those donuts.
Point of clarity. Sorry, Sarah. Tara says that every day.
Yeah, I do. It's true.
Get me those donuts.
Proceed, Sarah. Yeah. Sorry for the interruption.
Who doesn't? Bunch of, did someone order some donuts? The donut porn is great, but the show has such a good ear for its own balance of sort of like watching Marcus watching the donuts. And then that little scene where Neil and Marcus are like listening to the donuts. And then what they both land on is the like scented squishy toilet seat at your grandma's house. And they're just having this moment about it. And it's like, that's...
yeah.
Disgusting, but also beautiful, which is a pretty good description of like Neil as a character in the show's universe, actually.
Also identify the main trait of the toilet seat, which is the countdown decline after you sit on it. That little gas release that somehow happens. My grandmother had that seat too, and that was the best thing about it.
Oh, so did mine. Yep.
It takes like a second and a half to get to the bottom of it. Fantastic.
Yep. And it's that funeral home taupe.
Yep.
Always. Yeah. Oh, grandmas never change. Yeah, there's just something about this show. It can be very funny. And also, it is, like Tara said, extremely economical. Like, one of the reasons that Tina is one of my favorite characters is that both the writing and the performance are letting you project backwards to before, like, events before the show began, what it was like for her in that kitchen being sort of like the top bitch. And she, like the actor and the writing, all sort of get that done and let this evolution within a single episode and just one like potato prep sesh, they make that credible that she and Sydney get a little bit further in terms of their relationship. So I loved that. I loved that for the character. I'd also like to say, Cicero 2024, like this is the Oliver Platt is fucking killing it in this role at all times, no matter which timeline you're in. He's so good. He's like a little bit intimidating, but a little bit comforting at the same time, the way that that exact uncle is.
Yep.
In life, that this show can be in a place by its fourth episode where you completely believe some of the sort of on paper less credible dialogue about like parents and families and like, oh, what was your relationship like? Like, who is actually talking like this if there's not a camera there documenting this family?
Yeah.
But this show has gotten you there and sells it. And in no small part, it's because of the economical, like just shorthand that the characters use with each other. Mm-hmm. That scuffle over the inflated hot dog in the parking lot has already happened between these two in some way, like 17,000 times before. Your child asshole was just like, he is, but that's what we love. And then he's like, he has anxiety and dread. Whoa. And it's like played for laughs. And then there's kids passed out. And Cicero's like, yeah, this is better, right? It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
It's just so good. I love this show and just marvel at it often. So this was a delight to revisit.
One more thing I forgot to say is how well more economy is in the portrayal of Pete. And that when he shows up with his fucking tie and dress shirt and the vest.
Oh, God.
You
know,
like you can see before he even says anything, you know why all of these characters have so much contempt for him. Even though everything he's saying is perfectly nice, he's still loathsome on like some level. I mean, he comes back around in season two. But yeah, the portrayal of Pete, knowing he's like a Chicago theater legend, that actor is like very funny.
And was in those, he's in those ads.
And he's in the ads where he's
which I did not realize until recently that he's the one where he's like, he's trying to be in the elevator and he's like, oh, penthouse, an aristocrat. And the guy's like, okay, we're going to try that again. That was terrible. So good. Yep. No vanity. Anyway, this was great. Great presentation. I love that Chicago, New York perspective too. That was cool.
Yeah.
Dave.
Headcanon. This episode is the story that was told by somebody on The Sopranos. Doesn't it seem like they're all outside of the store?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, watching the traffic go by, and they're telling the story about Cicero's party that one time. Yeah. Where all their kids were just like fucking dead on the ground. Somebody thought the kids were dead.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that Cicero's like, well, are they dead? Like, not seeming to really care either way.
Yeah. Just curious. Yeah. Not invested. Yeah. It fucking sucks in here.
So good. Cicero is like your 10% Sopranos in The Bear, mm-hmm. which I think mm-hmm. is why like he gets such a good reaction every time he's on the screen. He brings that same energy to it. Like that, the dumb part of Sopranos, right? You know, like the bumbling mobster part mm-hmm. of Sopranos is well represented mm-hmm. in that character. When this episode came up, I was like really unsure because for me, the episode review, you know, the one with the DoorDash debacle, squeezed everything else out of my memory about season one of The Bear, because that was just like such a masterclass in anxiety making that I think it really just did everything else out of my head about that season. So when this came around, I'm like, okay, it's the funny one. Yeah. But it's really great. There's a lot of like really important, well-crafted, efficient character building via too soon inflated hot dog mascot that is just like, it's a masterclass in its own way. It's just not as loud.
Yeah.
I really did enjoy it. I think like the Xanax bit is way over the top. It feels like by the end of the second season that they wouldn't do that now. Mm. I think that's kind of a fault of the second season. I'm not saying it's like the
difference.
The second season follows a path of the show itself. That makes sense. Like there's something about when they decided to go from the beef to the bear as a restaurant, going from a blue collar hoagie shop or whatever they call them in Chicago. Don't at me. I know every region's got a different fucking name for a submarine sandwich, but whatever they call it, I guess they just call it beef.
It's
right?
A Hy-Vee, I think.
It's a Wawa. Then, like, just kidding.
It got, for me, less interesting the fancier the show got. And the stakes seemed different. I don't know. I just couldn't see the storyline operating in the second season or them trying it in the second season, if that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a shame because I feel like the show needs to reset once in a while to give you a breather. And I thought this was a good example of that. So,
yeah, mm-hmm.
absolutely.
All right. Let's put this to the official vote. Mr. David Weeb, canon worthy or not?
Yes. I heartily agree.
Tara?
Yes, and I'll add, more children's parties should involve dosing the guests with Xanax.
Based on all ours did.
Sarah?
It's a great woe for me. Yes, indeed.
All right, let's make that 4-4. So, The Bear, Season 1, Episode 4, Dog. You are hereby inducted into the extra on Great Canon.
Keep up the good work. You're killing it.
All right. Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
I used to do a bit on Twitter where I would tweet, like, I can't believe all of you still have not RSVP'd to my Suits premiere party. That one seems like the joke's on me because Netflix and Peacock just added Suits and people are going fucking apeshit for Suits. It debuted on both platforms in June. It broke a Nielsen streaming record for acquired programming, meaning like programming that they got from a previous broadcaster. And then Suits the next week broke that record 2 weeks in a row. So Suits beat Suits in terms of popularity. I mean, I used to watch Suits. Suits is fine, but like, is this really what we've come to? People, I guess, are just craving like straight up and down, not exciting procedural shows. Like, it's crazy that network TV is dying when network TV is Suits.
Tara, Suits is a Red Robin of television.
Yeah.
People just want Red Robin sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. I do want Red Robin most days when I'm not wanting donuts and sometimes one followed by the other. Anyway, congratulations to Suits. Everyone's going crazy for Suits.
And loser of the week, Sarah.
Oh, the power of Xenu compels me to inform you that the loser is the Church of Scientology. Leah Remini has... What?
Sorry. Oops.
Do you know what time it is? It's suit time. Leah Remini has filed suit
alleging harassment, stalking, and defamation on the part of the church, of which she is no longer a part. She is trying to end the church's retribution policies regarding, quote, suppressive persons. Her suit notes, among other things, that in the church it is considered, quote, a high crime to criticize Tom Cruise. The church, in turn, has suggested that Leah Remini move to Russia.
What?
Sure. That'll, yeah, I mean.
Love it or leave us?
It. Scientology has a lot of money, but I would not necessarily bet against Leah Remini in this,
no,
frankly.
No, I wouldn't either. If she's still mad after the show.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of both, still being mad after the show, do you know what time it is?
Oh, you're welcome. It's game time.
Welcome back to Game Time. This is the fifth game time of the season. Our scores are Tara with 2, Sarah with 1, Value Guess with 1. Today we are playing 19 Questions Weeb Edition from at EHGAssist on Twitter. All the TV things in today's 19 questions all come from TV shows that Mr. David Weeb watches enough to give him what I am calling game time confidence. They are, so everybody knows, so it's a fair level playing field. Arrested Development, Barry, Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad, Clone High, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Handmaid's Tale, The Office, The Other Two, Parks and Rec, Seinfeld, What We Do in the Shadows, and then anything Marvel TV and anything Star Wars TV. So everything we talk about in today's 19 questions game will be from one of those shows. There is one extra rule because you just got all the possible shows. Mm-hmm. You cannot ask me what show it is from.
Okay.
So you're going to have to ask around that question.
Got it.
Now, to remind you, if you ask me a yes or no question and you get a yes answer, you get to go again. If you get a no answer, then it proceeds to the next person in line. We go all the way until either we get the right answer or I get fed up and I move on to the next question. That okay. is the way it works. The rules are a little loosey-goosey on 19 questions, as you know, if you have listened to any of these before. No steal meals, no challenge zones. We go until I stop it.
Okay.
Are we ready to play 19 questions? We've edition? No, because we have to find out who's going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Sarah, Dave is our order today. Now we're ready to play 19 questions, Weeb Edition. Dave, you like hearing your last name so much?
I wanted to ask if there's a rule if a contestant is not able to lose a game that's named after them. So can we add that as a twist?
We'll find out.
All right. Here we go. Your first TV thing is an object. So I'm going to give you that piece of information.
Okay.
So this is an object. It's not a character or anything like that. It is an object.
Okay.
Tara, you go first. Give me a yes or no question.
Is it from a show that's currently on?
Yes, it is still in production.
Is it a comedy?
It okay. is not a comedy. To Sarah.
Is it on a streaming service? Is it a dystopian program?
I'll give you a yes on that one. I think you could describe it as dystopian.
Does it take place on Earth?
Ooh.
I should have phrased that differently, but enjoy.
Okay. Dave, that's good.
All right, to Dave.
Now, you can't ask, is it the show we think it is?
No. Is the show animated?
It's not. Back to Tara.
Okay. Is Diego Luna in the show?
He is.
Okay.
So now I will now tell you, it is Andor.
Okay, thanks.
You can't say it, but I can.
It's not the Star Wars adaptation of Y Tu Mama Tambien? Good
no.
to know. Okay. all right. Is it the...
I've watched that.
Is it the Whobat that he's got that he's trying to sell?
Okay. Whobat?
That's my dad's word for like thingamajig.
I love it.
So
yeah, I've never heard that
feel
before.
Free to spread it far and wide.
Like,
Whobat. H-O-O-B-A-T is okay. how I always spelled it in my head.
Okay.
Whobat.
Whobat. All right, Sarah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Sarah's. This is not Sarah's area of strength.
No, it's not. Is it sand? I'm out.
Is it something from the prison planet? thingy?
No. Good question, though. That filters out a lot of episodes.
It's not from Narkina 5?
Yeah.
Okay, something... Is it a droid?
For the record, I would probably put droids under characters.
Yeah, I thought that as soon as I said
it. You know how I feel about droids.
Yeah, I do.
Droids are people, too.
Yeah.
Is it a clothing item?
Not. Good question. Dave?
Is it a piece of technology?
Is it Marva's funeral stone?
It is. It is
nice.
The Marva brick.
Well done, T-Bone.
And Tara gets the first point. All right. Our second item is a location, a TV location. Tara got the point, so we start with Sarah.
All right. Is this location in a sitcom?
No. I hesitated on that one, but now I think about it, I should have buzzed way sooner. No, it's not a sitcom.
Okay.
All right.
Dave.
Oh, me. Is this from a traditional network TV series?
Okay. Is it from is it from a show from AMC?
It is not.
Is it animated?
No. Dave.
Is it on a streaming service?
Is it on a streaming service? Well, do you want to tighten up that answer?
Oh, proprietary only streaming.
Okay.
It does stream, as everything does.
Sure.
But it's not natively
streaming or whatever. Okay. What does that leave? Oh, okay. Is this from a show that stars Bill Hader? Okay. Are you going to confirm what show it is?
Yeah. Okay. It is Barry.
Okay. Is it NoHo Hank's house?
Okay. Is it his gun?
It's a location.
It's a location.
Oh, location.
I mean, you could put a pin on
it. Is it his gun locker? Is it?
I like how you doubled down on that one, though.
This game, I hate it back.
Is it Gene Cousineau's acting school?
That's what I was going to ask. Okay. Is it the trailer?
Is it whatever his girlfriend's name is? Is it her parents' house?
Sally.
Thank you.
Is it Sally's apartment?
Is it the office of the she streaming service where they tell her that her show has been canceled after one airing?
Nope. I will remind you there are ways to filter types of locations
and stuff like that
if you feel aimless.
Okay.
It's to Sarah.
Is it a city?
Good question. Not.
Is it someone's residence?
It's not.
Is it a place of business?
Yes.
Okay. Is it the office that has the statue of Cristobal in the lobby?
Is it the business we call show? I don't know the show.
No,
so
I'm here to hinder.
Is it the NoHo Hank's greenhouse / drug running outfit?
Nope.
Is it the diner where Sally works in Oklahoma or where there? Truck stop?
Nope.
Okay.
Is it a restaurant of any kind?
Yeah, I'll give you a yes on that one. But Sarah gets it.
Okay.
Is it a restaurant in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think so. Greater area, anyway.
Does the restaurant's name start with an A? I don't... Help me hinder people.
Restaurant.
The question was, is it a restaurant of any type or something
like
that? Yeah. It was super broad.
So it could be a drive-thru or a coffee shop or something. Mm. Okay.
Dave.
I have no clue about other places of business, so I'm going to say...
No, it doesn't start with an A.
Right, thank you. Is it a place Barry frequented?
Please, Tara.
Oh, my God. I know. I'm thinking. Okay, so it's not a place that Barry went. Who are the other characters?
Not a place Barry went often, I believe, is the question.
Okay, okay.
And I'm just reading the questions back to you.
Okay, is it a coffee shop?
Does it start with B?
No.
Is it the grocery store?
No, it's not the grocery store, but
that one grocery store.
Yeah, that one grocery store. No. All right, getting towards the end of my patience for this one, guys.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, finally. Right.
Fuck. I can't think of any location.
Okay. Turns out, Sarah, you got the last question for me.
Is it a national concern? Like a... Oh, yes. Okay. Is it McDonald's?
No. Dave, can you do it?
National McDonald's.
National concern, restaurant of some kind, does not start with A or B, I believe. Or the
right, it's clearly Red Robin.
It's Red Robin. It is not. I'm calling it. I'm fed up with you guys. It's Dave and Buster's.
Oh, of course. I forgot about that.
I tried.
You did. You did. You got us closer than we would have, but I totally forgot about that scene completely.
If I could award half points, and I just want to make clear, I can't, I would give you one. Okay. All right. Our next TV thing is a TV occupation.
Occupation.
And we're still with Sarah as first.
Okay.
Does the occupation require advanced degrees?
No. Could you involve it in government work?
Is it from a comedy? Okay.
Yes.
Is it a basic cable comedy?
Basic cable comedy. Yes.
Okay. Is Harvey Guillen in this show?
Yes.
Okay. So therefore it is.
What We Do in the Shadows.
Okay. Is the occupation familiar?
That's a good one.
Neither familiar nor familiar.
Okay.
For you.
Oh, gotcha. That's not an occupation, though. Is vampire considered an occupation in this game?
I'm sure there's professional vampires out there, but
you do need a degree for that. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay, good to know. Not in Staten Island. Come on.
I'm taking a stab and saying gym receptionist.
Is the... In the show, when we see it done, is it done by a male character? Okay. Is it done by Sean?
Bartender?
Ooh.
Can you ask a question? Can you ask a question? Just so I can... just give
is
me a full...
Is it a bartender?
It is.
Yeah.
It's not the answer, though.
Okay.
So you have to ask another question.
How is that not... Okay.
It's a specific kind. I know what he's getting at now.
Oh, okay. I don't know what specific is required here.
Yeah.
Is it a spring break bartender? I don't know.
No. All right. This is now to Dave. Occupation.
Is it a bartender that works at Naj's nightclub?
Oh.
Is it a regular human bartender in Railton, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I'll give you that. Normal human bartender.
Okay.
Yes. Normal human. Jackie Daytona, normal human bartender.
Yeah.
All right, so that's 2 points for Tara so far. Our next one shall be an action.
An action.
A physical action.
Okay.
All right, so to Sarah again.
Is the action done by a live action character?
Yes.
Is the character on a sitcom?
Yes.
Was the sitcom on a network?
Broadcast network?
Yes.
Ooh, now I'm thinking of all my shows and... okay. Is the sitcom on considered prestige TV on a premium streaming service?
So many questions. Just say, is it HBO?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
you can name a network. That's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Is it on HBO?
HBO?
The answer is yes.
All right. Is it a show produced and created by someone who had connections to Seinfeld?
Say his name.
I don't know why you think so.
Okay, so it's not Curb Your
that's
Enthusiasm.
That's what I was asking. That's what I was asking.
You
could have
said
yes.
Larry David is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't know how obtuse I had to be.
No.
I see. Got it. All right.
The only thing you can't ask is what show it is. Everything else is up.
Got it. Okay. Good to know.
All right. Tatar. Sitcom HBO. I think is what we had.
Okay.
Is Drew Tarver in this show? Okay. So it's... Well, I'm not going to say it.
It's the other two.
Yes. Okay. It's a gesture from the other two. Oh, is it the... smelly stank dance?
Nope. Okay. Good guess.
See someone.
To Sarah. Other two, a physical action.
Gestures. I just got it.
Oh, gestures is also it, a good way to put it.
butthole selfie?
No.
Wow, too bad. Hey, hole.
To Dave.
Brett's on busy.
Is it watching porn?
No.
Is it dabbing?
It is. But
is it Lance Dabbing?
It's Lance Dabs. Yeah, it's a Lance Dab. All right, Tara's got three so far. This game might be over, but I'm having fun, so let's keep going. This is a TV character. And let's just start with Dave this time.
Is it a live action character?
It is.
Is the character on a comedy?
No. All right, to Tara.
Is the character on an AMC show?
No.
Is the character in a dystopia?
Yeah.
Is the character on Earth?
I am not sure, so I'll say yes, but could be yes, could be
okay.
No.
Okay, that's interesting.
Well, I don't mean that canonically. I mean, I genuinely don't remember if they're on Earth or not, so I'll just let you ask more.
So it's probably not Handmaid's Tale, because that's definitely Earth.
Right.
Not Handmaid.
Alas. Okay. Is the character shown in different time periods?
I think so.
Okay, but that wasn't the definitive answer I was looking for.
Okay, well. Okay. Good news is you get to ask another question.
Yeah, true. Is the character based on Lucasfilm IP?
No.
Okay.
All right. Good run, though. Dave.
Is it part of the Marvel universe?
Yes.
Is it a man?
I don't know, so I'm going to ask you. I'm going to let you ask another one.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, wait, hang on a sec. I'm thinking, and I would say, based on something just popped in my head, yes.
Okay.
All right. Is it...
Can you get closer to the mic?
Oh, sorry about that. Ooh, I just want to take my stab. Is it Vision?
It's not Vision.
Okay, is this... Has the show had more than one season?
That's a great question.
No. One season so far.
Is it the show everyone hates?
No. It's not Secret Invasion.
Boy. Trying to narrow this down.
Dystopia, male character.
Yeah.
Maybe on Earth, maybe not. Different time area, space-time shit.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it from the series Loki? I'm going to ask, is it Loki?
No, it's not the answer, though.
Oh.
That's a piece of information that I can answer yes to.
It's a Loki.
Oh. Is it Alligator Loki?
It is Alligator Loki. I eventually said yes on mail because I think they said that Sophie?
Yeah.
Is the only female Loki at some point in the series.
That's right.
So, right.
I didn't extrapolate it backwards from that. Okay, so Dave's got one. Tara's got a bunch. Let's do...
One more.
Yeah, one more. Let's do... Okay, I think everybody knows this one. Let's do object. TV object. Tara starts.
Is it an object from a comedy?
No.
Is it an object from a prestige program?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is considered prestige TV.
Is it was it on an AMC show?
Yes.
Was it near Bryan Cranston at any point?
Yeah.
Is it a drug?
No.
Okay.
Dave.
Sorry, this is an object.
Object? Yep.
Is it a vehicle?
It is a vehicle. No.
Is it food?
No.
Stop doing both.
Sorry.
Is it pants?
No.
Is it lab equipment?
No.
Okay. Is it technology? I mean, in the sense of like, okay, is it a phone or something phone?
No.
Okay.
Is it, and it's not food, otherwise I would have said roof pizza. It's not a vehicle, shit, never mind. Is it the big cube of money?
Big cube of money.
Is it something that was in the White household?
No.
Okay, is it bigger than a bread box?
No.
Is it that joint that killed the kid? Yes. That's a drug, never mind. Oh well.
Sarah, that was my guess.
Ugh.
Did Jesse ever handle this?
Jesse. No.
Oh my god. The most annoying part is that we don't know which show it is from. Like, just because Cranston was near it doesn't mean it was necessarily on Breaking Bad. Because he was on both shows.
Yeah.
Did Bob Odenkirk have a bigger part in this show than in some other shows that were on AMC?
Did Bob Odenkirk have a bigger part in the show in question?
Yes.
No.
Okay, so it is Breaking Bad, presumably.
All right, well, we said it's not pants, but is it some other clothing item?
No.
Is it something Walter White used to harm someone else? Was it the only thing I'm thinking of is the bomb he stuck in Gus Fring's car?
Nope.
I mean, if it's smaller than a bread box, it's not a vat of acid. Did he ever kill anyone with a mineral? Is it a mineral? Okay.
Nope. All right, Sarah, what do you got? This one's going long.
Is it the vomit he let Jesse's girlfriend choke on? Like, I just don't know what's left.
And would that be considered food?
Smaller than a bread box?
Well.
All right. Let's hear it, Dave.
I'm just going to ask, is it his gun?
No.
I'm out. I can't remember anything.
All right, Tarzo, guys, I've been giving you so many fucking clues. At least 20
so
far.
Oh, God.
Sarah, go ahead.
This is explaining why he's been doing it this whole time. It's making me crazy.
Object. Breaking Bad. Not food. Definitely not pants. Smaller than a bread
box. Not from a lab.
Can
not
I
a money
tell
cube.
Sarah what it is?
No, you cannot.
Ugh.
You opted out.
You're right, I did.
Using it as a weapon.
Well,
gonna need a question here.
Is it the friends he made along the way?
No.
That he stuffed in a bread box and hit someone over the head with? Help me!
And I just want to clarify, it's not pants.
It's not pants. Definitely know it's not pants.
What about a pant?
No, it's not one pant. Not a pantaloon either.
Is it a legal item for someone to own?
No, it is not.
It's the bell. It's Salamanca's bell. That's why he's been ringing the bell this entire
ding,
round.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yes.
That's hilarious.
All right, that is the end of regulation. Everything has a purpose, guys. What are our final scores, Tara?
David has one. I have three. 4 points that were all very hard fought. Okay, by all of us.
Well done, Tara.
Tara! Tara.
Damn it.
All right, guys. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. Were you yelling at everybody during that last one? Please let us know on Twitter, on Blue Sky, on Discord, just how much you hated that last item. Well, guys, it was opening night for our discussion of season 3 of Only Murders in the Building. Before going around the dial with stops at Physical, Letterman Originals, Anthony Bourdain Parts Unknown, and of course, Star Trek Rainbow Delivery Services. Julie cooked up a canon order for the Bears season 1 episode Dogs. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from at ESG Assist. Next up is Red, White, and Royal Blue, plus recasting The Wire on Extra Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
child asshole,
Sarah D. Bunty,
Does it start with an F?
And David Weed.
I'm coming for you, Barbie.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grit.
The show can't go on. Stop.